rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, friends, back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, streaming on the Internet at RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, CRN Digital, and AirAmericaRadio.com. Robert Stacy McCain is with us. He's the co-author of Donkey Kong, Sex, Crime, and Corruption in the Democratic Party. Robert Stacy McCain, welcome to the program. If you can hear me, I can't hear you. Hopefully the guys running the board can.
Check one.
There we go.
Check
one. Robert Stacy McCain.
All right,
I got you.
Is this thing on, man?
It is. It's on, man. We're live and on the air.
All right. Well, I'm glad to be on with Air America. When they told me I was going on with you, and I said, do I get a purple heart for this? Only if he draws blood.
We'll know in 10 minutes. Tell me about how corrupt the Democratic Party is.
Well, the history, what we have written is a carefully documented 288 pages a history of the Democratic Party, going back from Aaron Burr to as far forward as the Abramoff Democrats, covering over 200 years. And the most recent, I had a reason to check the footnotes just the other day, and I noticed the most recent footnote in it was January 12th. And so we got up to about 3 months ago. So we're pretty good that it's pretty up to date. And Tom DeLay's resignation, as you may know from Chapter 12, is more or less hinted at. We could see it coming.
Tom DeLay's resignation is a consequence of the corruption in the Democratic Party?
Well, no.
Thank you for
asking. There, what we noted is a pattern. It's about a party and a pattern. And what we noticed is that there's a pattern that in Republican scandals always tend to end in three words: resigned, in disgrace. Whereas Democrats go on to heights of newer glory, Alcee Hastings, Barney Frank. There's no scandal that some Democrat can't manage to survive it. And it's an amazing thing that we were surprised to discover ourselves as we researched the book.
Well, you build a strong case for progressives, populists, people who of good conscience and people who really care about the Democratic Party to join it, infiltrate it, throw some of the bums out, because there certainly are some in the Democratic Party, and revitalize it, bring it back. But I'm curious
could I make a point?
Sure.
That was one of the things. This is not one of those ideological liberal bashing screeds. I mean, we get some shots in, okay? We got to take our shots, you know, but we make a few jokes. One of the things is that sometimes you have these liberal reformers come along, guys like Ed Koch. You know, Ed Koch, former mayor of New York, was one of the guys that put an end to Tammany Hall's corruption of the New York Democratic Party. So sometimes it's true, Franklin Roosevelt did a good bit, did great things to help clear up the corruption of his era.
Yeah, and Harry Truman, going after war corruption and war graft with the Truman Commission in 1942-43.
It was an amazing era.
Yeah, now how is it that Harry Truman, here is a guy who was a United States Senator from Missouri.
Right.
And we were at war, and the President was a Republican, the Senate was Republican, or excuse me, the President was a Democrat, the Senate was democratically controlled, and a Senator from the party of the President stood up and criticized the president and said, I think that there's corruption out here in these war contracts and some of these companies that are getting all these big bucks, and I'm going to ferret it out. And the president of the United States said, okay, go for it. And Harry Truman held hundreds of hearings, subpoenaed thousands of witnesses. Actually, people went to jail as a result of it. Contracts were voided. Millions of dollars were recovered. Yet the Republican Party today, in the Bush administration, I mean, we've got the GAO coming out and saying Halliburton is stealing from us, and there's a deafening silence among the Republicans. Why? Why don't the Republicans just do what the Democrats did?
Well, they may do that. As a matter of fact, one of the guys in the Abramoff scandals we talk about in Chapter 12, our conclusion of the book, is that Ralph Reed. Right now, he's going up against a guy named Casey Cagle down in Georgia for the lieutenant governorship of Georgia. And Ralph Reed, you know, he sold out his Christian conservative base, to shill for Abramoff's gambling clients. And the question is, are they going to pay him back? Are they going to do the right thing? You know?
That's literally a tempest in a teapot. I'm talking about the fact that we got a report out today from the General Accountability Office.
Right.
Came out yesterday that when we rebuilt Germany,
right,
the Marshall Plan, when we rebuilt Germany, we spent $4.3 billion in 1945 dollars. That's $29.3 billion in 2005 dollars.
Mm-hmm.
We rebuilt Japan, we spent $2.2 billion, which would be $15.2 billion in today's dollars. We have spent that amount of money now in Iraq. We've spent $28.9 billion rebuilding Iraq, and we spent $29.3 billion rebuilding Germany. We have spent as much money rebuilding Iraq as we did Germany, and all we have for it is a mess and a whole lot of corruption. We're talking, you know, there's $8 billion gone missing in Iraq just around these contracts, and I am not hearing one Republican talk about it. And every time the Democrats try to hold a hearing on this stuff, the Republicans refuse to allow it to happen.
Well, they need to stop that. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I have been so wrapped up in trying to get the book Donkey Kong's out there that I hadn't heard about this. But you have certainly got a good point that if Halliburton is chiseling. But, you know, one of the things, and let me say this, is that Halliburton, you know, paid my brother-in-law, an ex-Marine, to go over there and paid him $112,000 a year to drive a truck. You know, I guess that's...
Of your tax dollars and mine, that sounds like it qualifies for William Proxmire's Golden Fleece Award.
Well, now he's a great truck driver. I don't want to get you wrong, but it's basically...
The Army has some great truck drivers, and we're paying them about $1,500 a month.
Yeah, but as soon as they leave the Army, they can get hired. See, this is the civilian program.
And your brother can't be hired. He's
my brother-in-law.
Nobody would hire him, huh?
Yeah. Well, you know, he's had a hard time getting a job in Ohio.
So this is a welfare program. Halliburton is a welfare program for unhireable brother-in-laws.
I think that's a pretty
we're
good
talking, We're talking with Robert Stacey McCain. He's the author of Donkey Kong, Sex, Crime, and Corruption in the Democratic Party. The website, DonkeyKongs.com. Is the website. Robert Stacey McCain, you said that Republican scandals always end with somebody resigning. From 2001 to 2003, Republican staffers in the Senate Judiciary Committee were illegally hacking into over 5,000 computer files owned by Democrats, including, for example, Senator Ted Kennedy's computer. His computer was being hacked for almost 2 years. The Justice Department refused to investigate this. They tried to brazen it out. The Republicans in Congress won't investigate this. What would have happened when Bill Clinton was president if the Democrats had hacked into Tom DeLay's computer and gotten caught?
Well,
all hell would have broken loose.
Well, you know, the interesting thing though is that the aide who was doing that, the aide on the Republican staff of the
Manuel Miranda.
Manuel Miranda resigned in disgrace. Correct?
He's not there any longer, but in disgrace?
I'm not sure you could say that. He was forced out. Well,
he actually filed suit against the Department of Justice to end the investigation.
Okay, so here's the
He said the grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. That doesn't sound to me like a guy in disgrace. It sounds to me like a guy who's fighting back.
Well, anyways, let me say that, the question is the secret, is what is revealed by the leak, Is that the scandal?
Well, how about Dick Cheney's task force? Dick Cheney, when he came into office, as vice president, basically he has two jobs: to be the president of the Senate, which he does once or twice a year,
right,
and to be the lady in waiting for the president. And so Bush gave him two jobs. One was to run to the counterterrorism task force, which never met until 9/11, and thus we had the worst intelligence failure in the history of this country. And number two, to run an energy task force, which he went all the way to the Supreme Court to keep secret.
Yes.
So you don't think this is a scandal?
Well, you know, someone had brought this point up to me. Oh, well, what about the Hillary Clinton health care? You know, because there was a big uproar because she kept wanted the membership of her health care task force to be secret. You remember that?
But she took a lot of heat for it, and she ended up losing. But the point is, Dick Cheney is still keeping this stuff secret. He took Scalia duck hunting. and Scalia decided, well, you know, this
Inspector Duck kind of.
Yeah, well, I'm sure a lot of Republicans share your point of view, but you know, at the end of his term, Reagan had 138 of his officials, senior officials in the administration, convicted, indicted, or the subject of official investigations, more than any other president in history. How can you pick on the Democrats when the Republicans have the worst record of this?
Well, you know, we actually did count them, and we did a count of Congress, and it was 3-1 over the past 30 years. But listen, Tom,
Democrats, Republicans, we got to wrap it up, Robert. I'm just going to have to refer people to your website. I appreciate your being on the program with us. Robert Stacey McCain, DonkeyCons.com, the website, DonkeyCons, the book. Check it out. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. No, I think not. 21 minutes past the hour. Republicans, I don't think so. Coming up on today's program, by the way, is Democracy in America Under Attack by Capitalism and Iraq. Bev Harris from Black Box Voting is going to be here in the second hour of our program. In our third hour, don't miss Gary Smith, author of Help I Owe Back Taxes, talking about changing the tax system here. And you know what we can do. Our quote for the day from John Quincy Adams. Power always thinks it has a great soul and vast views beyond the comprehension of the weak, and that it is doing God's service when it is actually violating all his laws. John Quincy Adams, the son of John Adams. John Adams, the Federalist, what today would be called a Republican. John Quincy Adams, the what was then called the Democratic Republican Party. He saw the light, shall we say, unlike Bush and Bush. Although they like to draw the parallels. It's amazing, though, when you look back at the Reagan administration. I mean, by the end of his term, 138 Reagan administration officials convicted, indicted, or under investigation. Lynn Nofsinger, he was convicted on charges of illegal lobbying in the White House in the WedTech scandal. Michael Deaver received 3 years probation, was fined $100,000 after being convicted for lying to a congressional subcommittee and a grand jury. E. Bob Wallach, close friend and law classmate of Attorney General Ed Meese, 6 years in prison, WedTech influence peddling scandal. And although not convicted, Ed Meese III resigned as Reagan's Attorney General after having been the subject of investigation. So, you know, I guess the author, you know, I guess the author that we just had on was right, that the Republicans, they do get convicted. James Watt, maybe it's because their crimes are so egregious. James Watt, Reagan's Secretary of the Interior, indicted on 41 felony counts for using connections at HUD to help his private clients seek federal funds for housing projects in Maryland, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. He conceded he'd received $500,000, from clients who got favorable housing contracts. But he said, that's what they offered, and it sounded like a lot of money to me, and we settled on it. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison, 500 years community service. Iran-Contra. Director Casey was going to testify on this thing, but somehow the day of his testimony, the morning of his testimony, in fact, he was struck by a seizure in his office at the CIA. He was the guy who it seemed, according to his attorney, was going to testify before Congress, that he was the guy who set up the deal with the Iranians to hold the hostages over the election of 1980 so that Jimmy Carter would be defeated and Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. would become president and vice president. And Bill Casey was their campaign director. He was later made the CIA director. The morning of his testimony before Congress under oath, he was struck with a seizure in his office at the headquarters of the CIA. They rushed him off to the hospital, and they removed the part of his brain responsible for speech. I kid you not. The left temporal lobe broke his region, was removed from his brain. And this is what the Bushies do. They don't cut your tongue out. They cut your brain out. Ollie North, convicted of falsifying and destroying documents and accepting an illegal gratuity, aiding and abetting the obstruction of Congress. John Poindexter, guilty of five crimes and criminal counts, including conspiracy to mislead Congress, obstructing congressional inquiries, lying to lawmakers, using high national security to mask deceit and wrongdoing. He's back in the government now. Richard Secord pled guilty to a felony charge of lying to Congress over Iran-Contra. Casper Weinberger, recently deceased, Secretary of Defense, in June of 1992, indicted by a federal grand jury on charges of concealing from congressional investigators and prosecutors thousands of pages of handwritten notes, all of this leading back to Iran-Contra once again. Elliot Abrams, appointed by Reagan in 85, closely linked to the head of the State Department's Latin America Bureau. He pled guilty to two charges, reduced to misdemeanor, sentenced in 1991 to 2 years probation. He was pardoned by George Bush Sr. Robert McFarlane, appointed Reagan's national security advisor in October 83, became well known as a champion of the MX missile program. In 84, well, you know, he was fined $20,000, received 2 years probation, pled guilty to four misdemeanors. He said, "What drove me to despair was a sense of having failed the country." Yes, this is because he tried to commit suicide with Valium. Unfortunately, it takes an awful lot of Valium to kill a person. I'm not even sure it's possible. Ann Fires was the chief of the CIA's Central American Task Force. Fires pled guilty in 1991 to two counts of withholding. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. And that's the people who got caught in the Reagan administration, the people who haven't gotten caught in the Bush administration. You got Halliburton's no-bid bonanza. You got Memogate, the Senate computer theft. You got the Energy Task Force scandal of Cheney. Halliburton pumping up prices. Halliburton vanishing money. Halliburton bribing people. The bribe-palooza. $100 million in bribes to Nigerian officials alleged to have been paid by Halliburton between 95 and 2002, when Cheney was the CEO, I might add. Money order, the Afghanistan's missing $700 million, it turns up in Iraq, according to Bob Woodward's plan of attack. Wiretapping the United Nations. And nobody was ever held to account for this, but it came out. The Medicare bribe scandal. Nick Smith in Michigan says that he was offered a $100,000 bribe for his vote. That never got resolved. The Medicare money scandal. Tom Scully says that he was threatened with losing his job if he told Congress the truth about how much the Medicare was going to cost. The bogus video news releases. The GAO has said this is illegal. The Bush administration is still doing these things. Pundits on the payroll. The Armstrong-Williams case. Ground Zero's unsafe error. We were lied to about that. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you. Only you can let it in. No one else can speak the words on your lips. Put yourself in what's unspoken. Live your life with arms wide open.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Speaking of high crimes and misdemeanors, speaking of what George W. Bush Sr. called treason, there was a senior administration official in the White House who leaked the name of a CIA agent, bringing down Brewster Jennings, an entire CIA covert operation, and putting the lives of, possibly ending the lives of CIA officers and agents around the world and informers. We don't know the extent of the damage because the Bush administration will not release the information even to Congress. But we do know that considerable damage was done from the CIA agents who have come out and spoken about this. Who was this senior administration official who leaked this information, speaking of the crimes of the Bush administration? It turns out, according to papers filed today by Patrick Fitzgerald in court, that we have a little better idea of who it was George W. Bush was speaking of when he said that he didn't know who the senior administration official might be who could have leaked the information.
And I don't know. We're going to find out the senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Well, he doesn't have any idea. Well, the New York Sun has an idea. This is an article by Josh Gerstein, an exclusive for The Sun. A former White House aide under indictment for obstructing a leak probe, I. Lewis Libby, testified to a federal grand jury that he gave information from a closely guarded national security estimate on Iraq. That's also known as leaking classified information, my friends. To a New York Times reporter in 2003 with the specific permission of George W. Bush. The new disclosure could be awkward, writes Gerstein, for the president because it places him, for the first time, directly in a chain of events that led to a meeting where prosecutors contend the identity of a CIA employee, Valerie Plame, was provided to a reporter. He goes on to note, no criminal charges have been brought for the leak itself, but Mr. Libby, a former chief of staff to Vice President Cheney, was indicted in October on charges that he obstructed the investigation, perjured himself in front of the grand jury, and lied to FBI agents who interviewed him. This is what Fitzgerald wrote. Quote, defendant, that's Libby, testified that he was specifically authorized in advance of the meeting to disclose the key judgments of the classified NIE to Miller, that's Judith Miller of the New York Times, on that occasion, because it was thought that the NIE was pretty definitive against what Ambassador Wilson had said, and that the vice president thought that it was, quote, very important, end quote, for the key judgments of the NIE to come out. He goes on to say, Mr. Libby is said to have testified that at first he rebuffed Mr. Cheney's suggestion to release the information because the estimate was classified. However, according to the vice presidential aide, Mr. Cheney subsequently said he got permission for the release directly from Mr. Bush. As Fitzgerald wrote, quote, defendant testified that the vice president later advised him that the president had authorized defendant to disclose the relevant portions of the national intelligence estimate. Mr. Libby also told the grand jury that he also sought the advice of the legal counsel to the vice president, David Addington, who indicated that Mr. Bush's permission to disclose the estimate, quote, amounted to a declassification of the document, end quote, according to the new court papers. In other words, Scooter Libby did nothing wrong because it was the president's idea. And if the president says it's okay because this is a kingdom after all. Don't you get it? Don't you know? We live in an official theocracy. And
I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah. And now we know. Now, that's only a part of the news today. In addition, Federal Communications Commission Chairman Kevin Martin. This is the new guy in charge of the FCC. He's replaced Colin Powell's son. They bounced him out of there as revenge for Colin Powell coming out and saying that the low point of his life was when he had to lie before the United Nations. New FCC Commission Chairman Kevin Martin. This is from Editor and Publisher magazine, the magazine for magazine publishers and newspaper publishers. Said newspapers must educate the public about the changing media landscape and the benefits of ending the 31-year-old ban on same-market ownership of newspaper and broadcast stations. See, right now, it's illegal for a radio station and a newspaper to be owned by the same corporation. The reason it's illegal? Well, because that corporation might have interests in the community that they would want to either advance or conceal. And if they owned both the radio station, the television station, and the newspaper, they would be in a more efficient position to do it. Or they may have candidates, toady candidates that they want to promote. And if they own all the media, this is a Berlusconi alert writ large, right? So the chairman of the FCC, at a meeting at the McCormick Place Convention Center, talking to newspapers, says the failure to implement these rule changes is not our fault alone. The public is not convinced of the need to change these rules, and if you can't convince the public, our chances to do that are dim. He's talking to the newspapers. He said newspapers are the only medium specifically prohibited from owning a single broadcast station in its own market. He said he had hoped to begin working on the repeal this summer. We'll talk about the end of democracy as we know it. As I mentioned in the first segment of the hour, we have now spent officially as much money in Iraq, rebuilding Iraq, as we spent rebuilding Germany. Does it look to you like the results are a little different? Could it have to do with Democrats know how to fight and win wars. After all, the Republicans always used to refer to World War I and World War II as those Democrat wars. Democrats know how to fight and win wars, and Democrats know how to put together a country, put a country back together after the war is over so that it can become, well, Germany and Japan, in the case of Germany and Japan, the second and third largest economies in the world. And what has happened now to the people who put together this Bush disaster? Over at Think Progress, they compiled a report reviewing the key architects of the war. Paul Wolfowitz, one of the leading guys, he's the guy who said we'd be greeted as liberators. He said that Iraq oil money would pay for the reconstruction. He said Eric Shinseki, the general, when he said that we're going to need several hundred thousand troops, was wildly off the mark. He's now promoted to head the World Bank. Doug Feith, he was the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, another neocon. He spearheaded two secretive groups at the Pentagon, the Counterterrorism Evaluation Group and the Office of Special Plans. These are the groups that grew up, that put together the phony documentation that purported that there was a tie between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. Where is he now? Well, he voluntarily resigned from the Defense Department. Now he's co-chairman of a project at Harvard University's John F. School of Government to write an academic book on how to fight terrorism. Just what we need. Stephen Hadley, he was the Deputy National Security Advisor, Condi Rice's number two person. He disregarded memos from the CIA and a personal phone call from George Tenet warning that references to Iraq's pursuit of uranium should be dropped from Bush's speeches. On January 26th of last year, he was promoted to National Security Advisor. He's now in charge of our national security. Yeah. Richard Perle, the so-called Prince of Darkness, chairman of the Defense Policy Board. He suggested that Iraq had a hand in 9/11. In 96, he authored Clean Break, a paper that was co-signed by Doug Feith and others arguing for regime change in Iraq. This was during the Clinton administration in 96. Currently, he's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he specializes in national security and defense issues. And he shows up a lot as a talking head on TV. Elliot Abrams, one of the defendants in the Iran-Contra affair, pled guilty to two misdemeanor counts of withholding information from Congress. He was appointed special. This was back in the Reagan administration. Well, Bush appoints him special counsel to the president and senior director of National Security Council for Near East and North African Affairs during Bush's first term, chief advisor on the Middle East. His name surfaced as part of the investigation into Plamegate. Where is he now? He's now the Deputy National Security Advisor. Number two guy in our national security apparatus. Aren't you reassured? David Wormser, another one of the guys who put together the administration's plan to go into Iraq and to occupy it. At the time of the war, he was the special assistant to John Bolton in the State Department. Long advocated the belief that both Syria and Iraq represent threats. In early 2001, before 9/11, he was calling for airstrikes against both Iraq and Syria. Now, he was promoted to principal deputy assistant to the vice president for national security affairs. He is in charge of coordinating our strategy in the Middle East. It just goes on and on. Dan Bartlett. Dan Bartlett was the White House communications director at the time of the war. He was the mouthpiece in hyping the Iraq threat. He was also a regular participant in weekly meetings of the White House Iraq group, WHIG, W-H-I-G. Main purpose of the group was the systematic coordination of the marketing of going to war with Iraq, as well as selling the war here at home. Whereas he now, he's just got promoted to counselor to the president. He's responsible for the formulation of policy and implementation of the president's agenda. Mitch Daniels, he was the director of the Office of Management and Budget. He's responsible for releasing the initial budget estimates that said the Iraq war was only going to cost $50 to $60 billion. Now we're looking at a trillion. Where is he now? He's the governor of Indiana. The Republicans rewarded him very well for this. George Tenet, he wins the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Colin Powell, making money in the private sector, doing well. He's going to be the number two to Henry Kissinger. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, indeed, my friends. Dreaming of democracy. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And we've got to hold on tight to our dreams. And not only that, we've got to act on them. We've got to get out there and get active. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, toll-free nationwide. You can drop into our live chat room by going to tomhartman.com and clicking the live chat link. Bob in Dearborn, Michigan on the line. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I love your show. I wish you were on for more than just an hour, though.
You're talking on Sirius Satellite Radio?
On Sirius, yeah.
All 3 hours of the program are carried on Sirius. The second and third hour are delayed a couple of hours, and then they actually rerun the entire show during the night, and then they rerun it on the weekend. So keep listening,
great.
And it'll come back.
You know, with that whole list of names that you just gave, to my way of thinking, there's a common denominator there. Outside of Colin Powell, what do all those people have in common? Whenever they had a chance to serve in any type of war, they did their best to get out of it.
Yeah, good point.
And that's a farce.
Yeah. Chicken hawks.
Chicken hawks. If this testimony that Libby gave to the grand jury and to Fitzgerald, if that holds, if this is all true, is he going to end up having to fire himself?
Yeah.
And one quick thing.
In our dreams, Bob.
I think most people think, well, at least I do, I think he's probably the least intelligent person to ever hold that office. Is it possible the people in that administration think that, you know, maybe there's a lot of people who really think he is stupid, and
yes,
they couldn't be this stupid to, you know, to do this?
Yes. I don't have personal connections into the high levels of the Bush administration, but I actually have friends who do. And there is a broad consensus, at least so I'm told, among his advisors or so many of the people close to him, that they have to protect him, that he's very volatile, he's dangerous, people are afraid of him. They don't consider him intellectually competent, and they don't consider him emotionally stable.
Yeah, I'm not.
And this is not bash Bush. I mean, this is
no. I'm not bashing
this,
him either.
This is what history is going to tell him. I'm telling you.
I've heard him say before that he seems to think that people really understand him. I don't know anybody who talks like him.
Yeah. Yeah, neither do I. And
I wouldn't associate with somebody who spoke English like that.
Yeah, well, and it's a sad thing that.
But he's running our country.
But what can you say? I mean, you know, what that means is, Bob, and thank you for the call. What that means is that we have to get politically active, and also we have to keep in mind that George W. Bush is not ever going to run again for elective office, and our focus should not be on George W. Bush. It should be on the entire Republican culture of corruption and the entire Republican agenda to destroy all of the gains that were made in this country from the 1930s to up until the 1980s when Ronald Reagan came in and declared war against working people in this country. Alex in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Alex, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's great talking to you.
Thanks for calling.
How about writing a book about biggest crime in history that didn't happen yet, but they tried, Republicans, they tried their best. And this crime is worse than Osama bin Laden. A couple months ago, they tried to sell back Alaska, state of Alaska, back to Russians for $17 trillion.
No.
This offer was turned down in a couple of weeks after that.
Alex, I can't believe it. I'm sorry. It's got to be.
I picked it up on the Russian news.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean it's true. I mean, it's Alaska is now a state. It's not possible.
You don't believe it?
No, I don't believe it.
Simply because it wasn't in the media.
Yeah, no, just because it's in the media, it doesn't mean it's true. I don't believe it. But it's an interesting story, and it's fascinating that the Russian news is reporting it. And what would be really interesting would be to find out why they're reporting that. Why would the Russian news be reporting that?
They said they wouldn't take it even for $1 trillion because state of Alaska will need at least extra $30 trillion extra investment.
Yeah, interesting, because Bush has so destroyed the infrastructure of the country. Interesting. Alex, thanks for the call, and thanks for the heads up. I you know, it's news to me. Brent in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Brent.
Hey, Tom. Love your program.
Thank you.
Wanted to, in that long litany of scandals, I'm reminded of a biblical scripture, and I can't remember exactly one, in which Christ talks of the Pharisees as they'll swallow the camel, but they'll gag on a gnat.
Right.
What I wanted to, I watched the president this morning explaining the war 4 years after the fact, and he's desperate.
Sure.
You can hear it and see it. But in one of his, in his explanation of the war, he never mentions the anthrax attacks.
No, and this administration has been incredibly silent on that, and you would think that it would be something that they could use to continue to whip up fear. And the fact that they're completely silent about it, really,
suspicious.
Yeah, and consider the timing. The Patriot Act was put before Congress. Jim Jeffords had left the Republican Party, so the United States Senate, which it had to get through, was now in Democratic hands. Pat Leahy, the senator from Vermont, was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. It had to get through his committee. And Tom Daschle was the head of the Senate. And Tom Daschle as the lead Democrat in the Senate. Daschle and Leahy were the two men who could stand in the way of the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act was submitted, and only two guys in the United States Senate in Washington, D.C., got anthrax in the mail, had to leave their offices, were totally terrified, and had to leave behind all the papers that might have said, hey, don't do the Patriot Act. They literally had to leave their offices until after the vote was over. And who were those two people? Pat Leahy and Tom Daschle. Now, you tell me that doesn't stink. And I don't consider myself a conspiracy theorist, but there's something going on here. And why is nobody talking about this? I mean, we got all these people investigating 9/11. I'd love to see a good book investigating the anthrax attacks and finding out what's going on with that. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, they're going at it here in the United States Senate. John McCain, Ted Kennedy, putting together this immigration bill. Bill Frist, the majority leader, the Republican, says, we've had a huge breakthrough overnight. Harry Reid, Democratic leader, agreeing. Interesting. Senate Republicans and Democrats closed in on a last-minute compromise today on legislation opening the way to legal status and eventual citizenship for many of the 11 million immigrants living in the United States illegally. This is from the Associated Press. We'll see how this thing all shakes out. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be very interesting. You know my thoughts on this. I don't think I need to repeat them at length. There are very real issues that have to do with human beings involved here, and there are very real issues that have to do with our economy. And what I've been saying all along is that David Ricardo laid this thing out back in 1813, 1814 in his Iron Law of Wages. The famous economist David Ricardo, building on the work of Adam Smith in 1776, and Say's first name, as well as Dessoult de Tracy, the French economist. All of these guys writing more or less around the same time, in the late 1700s, early 1800s, and the so-called liberal school of economics, and which is not actually liberal in today's meaning of the word. It would be more like the laissez-faire school of economics. And David Ricardo said, you know, just came right out, laid it out, and said that if the pool of labor exceeds the demand for labor, in other words, if there's more people around willing to work than there are jobs, then the price of labor will fall. And if the pool of labor is significantly greater, what he called infinite. In other words, if the pool of labor is so large that there's no possibility of all the jobs soaking up all the people. In other words, if you have an unemployment rate above zero, then eventually, slowly, but eventually, wages will drop to what David Ricardo referred to in 1813, 1814 as the subsistence level. What today in the United States we would refer to as the working poor, the poverty level. And there are folks who are gung-ho in favor of this. Gung-ho in favor of this. They are the people who are in bed with the very large corporations, the multinational corporations. On the Republican side, it's most of the Republican Party. You've got a few who are hysterical racists, frankly, who are concerned about Mexicans and South Americans, Central Americans coming into the United States. You got a few of them. But by and large, the Republicans are on the corporatist side, and they're saying, hey, you know, more labor. Reagan signed in 1986 an amnesty, and look what it is. Brought another 5 million illegal aliens into the United States, figuring that, you know, we had one amnesty, we'll have another. So you've got the corporatist Republicans on this side, and on the Democratic side, you've got the corporatist Democrats, the Democratic Leadership Council. Now, there are some Democrats who, in my opinion, are just confused. They understand, as I said, that there's real human beings involved here. You got the labor unions, for example, who are saying, well, yeah, let's bring these folks in. Let's make them part of the, you know, in the hopes that they'll become members of the union. What they don't realize is that a labor union can only exist viably if there's not a surplus of workers. If there's a surplus of workers, employers are always going to be able to bust unions. So, you know, the unions think that they can absorb all these folks and bring them all together and make one big happy union, and they're dreaming. And then you've got, you know, the DLC, the conservative Democrats. And I was disappointed, very disappointed to see on Think Progress, I posted yesterday afternoon, this piece, Think Progress, the progressive website, thinkprogress.org, the recent focus on immigration has provided an opportunity to knock down several prominent myths about the issue, that mass deportation of 12 million people is a feasible solution. Well, of course, that's a myth. It's stupid. You stop hiring them, they'll leave. They figured out a way to get here, they'll figure out a way to get home. I mean, if you stop hiring them, they'll want to leave. You can simply say, here, we'll give you a free bus ticket. Anyhow, they continue. That hardline enforcement-only proposals will actually reduce illegal immigration. Well, they will if they're directed toward employers. And this is my criticism of the Republican proposal that came out of the House of Representatives, is that it primarily criminalizes workers and those who are helping workers rather than employers. But, of course, that's the Republican way. Anyhow, back to Think Progress, or that undocumented workers don't pay taxes. Well, of course they pay taxes. I don't know why. This is a straw man argument. They're putting out these three straw man arguments and then saying they can knock them down. Then they go on to say another common misperception is that increased immigration has had a negative impact on wages for lower skilled U.S. born workers. But as Princeton University professor Alan Kruger shows in a new American Progress memo, the actual impact of immigration on lower-skilled workers is negligible. Why? One likely factor, in addition to increasing the supply of labor, immigrants increase the demand for goods and services produced in the U.S. This leads to higher wages and employment of all workers in the U.S. Immigration can also result in an increase in capital investment, and many immigrants become entrepreneurs, creating jobs for other immigrants and natives. The latest U.S. Census data show that Hispanic-owned businesses now comprise one of the fastest-growing segments in the U.S. economy, end quote. Yes, that's all true. Over time. I mean, what you're seeing is, for example, the waves of immigration into the United States after the Civil War in the 1870s, the 1870s, 1880s, up until that time, waves of immigration coming from Asia into the West Coast, waves of immigration coming from Europe into the East Coast of the United States from the 1890s through basically 1920, when we put a limit on immigrants. But that did not grow the economy at that time. What it did was it depressed wages. over time, of course, yeah, over time, an economy will absorb people. There's no doubt about that. If we absorb, you know, 11 million immigrants, sure, they'll eventually become consumers, and the economy will eventually grow to absorb them. But over the short term, they're going to continue to depress wages. Anyhow, as the Think Progress folks say, as Kruger writes, if we are serious about helping low-income workers, we need to act now on measures that can have a much larger impact, like expansion of the earned income tax credit, an increase in the child tax credit, a boost in the minimum wage, and increased job training. Well, sorry, but no cigar. First of all, the earned income tax credit and an increase in the child tax credit, you know, this is saying, let's just acknowledge the fact that we're going to have a massive underclass of the working poor in the United States, in large part because of these immigration policies that apparently the folks that Think Progress are even advocating. And I think that's tragic. Secondly, they say we should boost the minimum wage. Well, I agree the minimum wage should be boosted, but the simple reality is, you know, Tom DeLay, a couple of years ago, he said, you know, nobody pays the minimum wage. The fact of the matter is very few people pay the minimum wage, but as long as you have illegal labor willing to work for any wage, the minimum wage is irrelevant on the one hand. And secondly, the minimum wage reflects the cost of labor in society. It doesn't lead it. It reflects it. So if you want to increase the minimum wage, stop illegal immigration into the United States, or stop employers from hiring illegal immigrants, and suddenly there'll be a few million people out of work in the United States, and that will create demand on the part of employers, and in order to get Americans to do those jobs, they're going to have to pay a decent wage. They start paying a decent wage, and the average wages in the United States go up, and then the Republicans will go, hey, everybody's making 8, 10, 12 bucks an hour anyway, let's raise the minimum wage to 6 bucks. Or 7 bucks. I mean, you know, they'll do something perfunctory. The fact of the matter is that states across the Oregon, here where I'm broadcasting from, we have one of the highest minimum wages in the nation. I think it's $7.25 an hour. It has helped our economy. But the fact of the matter is that that we are not in a net surplus of labor position in this state yet. Or maybe we're on the edge of it. And then they say increased job training. Well, yeah, increased job training for what jobs? For what job? If you want an engineering job, that's being outsourced to India. You want a manufacturing job, they're being outsourced to China. Are you going to train people to be better busboys? I'm really saddened to see this, because I have a lot of respect for the folks over at Think Progress. And to see them drinking this Kool-Aid coming from the Tom Friedman bunch, the Tom Friedman branch of the Democratic Party, the DLC branch, the Evan Bibe branch of the Democratic Party, I think it's just a shame. In the meantime, John McCain, day before yesterday, gets up and gives a speech before a bunch of labor workers, the AFL-CIO Building and Convention Trades Department, and they booed at him. And he says, well, there's some jobs Americans just won't do. And one member, he shouts out, pay a decent wage. He says, I've heard that before. And then he says, I'll pay 50 bucks an hour if you'll go down and pick lettuce in Arizona. And a guy shouted, I'll take it. And Kane says, you got to do it for the whole season. You can't do it, my friends. I'm telling you, 50 bucks an hour, there's no shortage of Americans who will do that. David will do that. David right here, my producer. I'm going to lose my producer. He's going to go pick lettuce. Hey, you know, we'll see if McCain keeps his promise. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And the lonely voice of you cries, what is truth? A little boy of 3, sitting on the floor, looks up and says, Daddy, what is war? Son, that's when people fight and die. A little boy of 3 says, Daddy, why? Young man of 17 in Sunday school, being taught the golden rule. And by the time another year's gone around, it may be his turn to lay his life down. Can you blame the voice of you for asking what is true?
Amazing. A Johnny Cash song from back in the 70s, early 70s, when the war protests were going on in the streets. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just tried to call John McCain's office. I called 1-888-888-355-3588, the toll-free number for Congress. There's also a direct line, 202-225-3121 for the switchboard. Ask for John McCain's office. Got a recording that said, if you'd like to leave a message on an issue, dial 1. If this is an emergency and you need to talk to a staffer, dial 2. So the first time I called, I dialed 2, and I immediately got a busy signal. In other words, I got disconnected. So I called back and thought, okay, I'll leave a message. And the message I was going to leave went something like this. I understand Senator McCain is offering $50 an hour to pick lettuce in Arizona. And, you know, I'm having a lot of fun doing this talk radio gig, but that's good, pretty good money. So I'd like you to consider me. Put me on the list. And David, my producer here, he's a definite. You know, he enjoys producing a talk radio show, but $50 an hour, he could save up some money. So put us on the list here. Here's my name. Here's my phone number. And, you know, when lettuce season comes, let us know. And that was going to be my message. So I called back and it said, you know, if you need to talk to a staffer, push 2. And I knew that wasn't going to work. And if you need to leave a message about an issue, push 1. And so I pushed 1. And then I got a message that said, the mailbox for this number is full. So I guess if you want to call John McCain's office and apply for one of those $50 an hour jobs picking lettuce in Arizona, you're going to have a bit of a challenge. You may have to call his local office in Washington, D.C. Phoenix. And presumably he actually has several offices in Arizona. And so if anybody has any success reaching his office in Arizona or any of his offices in Arizona and applying for these jobs that John McCain is offering for $50 an hour throughout the season picking lettuce, let me know. Let me know. Sounds interesting. Now, with regard to aliens, perhaps we should simply... Now, I say this, frankly, tongue-in-cheek, because I think this is draconian, but Frank Gaffney in the Washington Times, the Mooney newspaper in Washington, D.C., which is the only newspaper that George W. Bush reads, wrote an op-ed piece on April 4th titled The Mexican Solution, in which he simply quotes the Mexican Constitution. This is the official translation of the Mexican Constitution published by the Organization of American States, the OAS. So this is as clean as you can get. Article 33 of the Mexican Constitution, quote, foreigners may not in any way participate in the political affairs of the country, end quote. This ban applies, among other things, to participation in demonstrations and the expression of opinions in public about domestic politics, like what we just saw in L.A. and New York. Here's another one. Equal employment rights are denied to immigrants, even legal ones. Article 32 of the Mexican Constitution. Natural-born Mexicans shall have priority over foreigners under equality of circumstances for all classes of concessions and for all employment, positions, or commissions of the government in which the status of citizenship is not indispensable. Here's another one. Jobs for Mexican citizenship is considered indispensable, for which Mexican citizenship is considered indispensable. In other words, those jobs in Mexico for which you have to be a native-born Mexican, you cannot be an immigrant, according to Article 32 of the Constitution, bans foreigners, immigrants, and even naturalized citizens of Mexico from serving as military officers, on Mexican-flagged ships, on Mexican-flagged airlines, and as chiefs of seaports and airports. Article 55 of the Mexican Constitution denies immigrants, legal immigrants to Mexico, the right to become federal lawmakers. A Mexican congressman or senator, quote, must be a Mexican citizen by birth, end quote. Article 91 further stipulates that immigrants may never aspire to become cabinet officers as they are required to be Mexican by birth. Article 95 says the same about Supreme Court justices. As Frank Gaffney notes, in accordance with Article 130, immigrants, even legal ones, may not become members of the clergy either. You can't become a member of the clergy in Mexico if you're not born there. Foreigners, to say nothing of illegal immigrants, are denied fundamental property rights. For example, Article 27 states, now keep in mind, this is at a time when banks in the United States are competing to write mortgages for illegal immigrants, aliens in the United States. The Mexican Constitution, Article 27, quote, only Mexicans by birth or naturalization and Mexican companies have the right to acquire ownership of lands, waters, and their appurtenances, or to obtain concessions for the exploitation of mines or of waters. Mexico grants its citizens the rights to arrest illegal aliens and hand them over to police for prosecution. Imagine if the Minutemen had such a right. The Mexican, not that I'm a big fan of them, but still. The Mexican Constitution states that foreigners, not just illegal immigrants, may be expelled for any reason and without due process. But Vicente Fox says that we're wrong. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Life's tough to walk around the world to ease my troubled mind. I left my body lying somewhere in the sands of time. But I watch the world look to the dark side of the moon. I feel there's nothing I can do.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Let's see, $50 an hour to pick lettuce. That's about $100,000 a year, isn't it? $50 an hour? I don't know. We'll have to. Somebody needs to do the math on that one. I think it's around $100,000 a year. And you know, Americans. Nell sends me an email. She says Americans muck septic tanks and clean the sewers in New York City. They clean stables and help the ill in hospital. Season in the Arizona sun is a piece of cake in comparison, especially for $100,000 a year. Yeah. Yeah, that's $50 an hour. That's a deal. So anyway, as I shared with you the Mexican Constitution, I think that it's ironic. That was the point of the piece. It's just Mexico would not do what we are planning on doing. No country would. Countries or very few countries would. Countries understand. Most nations understand that. There is a reason. At $50 an hour, it's $106,000 a year. Jeez. David, you going to pick the lettuce for $106,000 a year?
Oh, yeah.
You're on your way?
Oh, yeah. Overtime and all.
Oh, man. What am I going to do? I'm going to have to get a new producer?
I'm sorry. If you match the pay, I'll stay.
See, there you go. That's Ricardo's iron rule of wages, right? It's yeah. At the moment, well, I guess you know how much David's not making. So anyway, I have a feeling it's going to be, you know, that John McCain is going to live to regret having said that. It's going to be really interesting to see if people start taking him up on it. It wouldn't surprise me to see Lou Dobbs putting up something on his website. You know, call here or list your job application here. I mean, how much money does McCain have that he's willing to pay this kind of money? This is pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. Walmart CEO Lee Scott announces a new gig for Walmart.
I hate Walmart.
Our Walmart alert for the hour.
Historic. Well, here's how it is. Big company sell for low cost. Drive mom and pop out of business. Pretty soon all over the land. One big square store. Identical brand. And that's why I hate.
And that's the thing, one identical store all over the land. What's happening now is Walmart is moving into low-income neighborhoods, places where you go for the cream first and then you go for the milk, right? I mean, that's the rule of thumb in retailing. You go first where you're going to make the most money, and then you go to where you can make some money, and then you go where you can make a little bit of money. And right now, one of the last bastions, in fact, of real free enterprise of small family businesses in the United States are our inner cities and our low-income communities. These are the places where immigrants start businesses. You know, the stereotypical Korean greengrocer, the local Hispanic store, and Walmart is going to eat their lunch. They are, by the way, promoting this as good news. The news release from Walmart, this is directly from Walmart. They sent it to us in email, and presumably all the other talk show hosts out there. In a speech this afternoon at the Newspaper Association of America's annual convention, Walmart Stores CEO Lee Scott will announce the new nationwide Walmart Jobs and Opportunity Zones Initiative. Now, what do you want to bet? Because they're moving into what are referred to sometimes euphemistically as depressed areas, that they're also going to be getting government grants, tax breaks. Well, I'm speculating. Here's the news release. Scott also will announce that over the next 2 years, Walmart will build more than 50 stores in neighborhoods with high crime or unemployment rates on sites that are environmentally contaminated or in office buildings or malls in need of revitalization. These stores are expected to create between 15,000 and 25,000 jobs, many of which will be in minority communities, and generate more than $100 million in state and local tax revenue for those communities. They go on to say, Lee Scott, the president, the CEO, he says, Walmart has never been afraid to invest in communities that are overlooked by other retailers. No, because their plan is to conquer the world. Say goodbye to minority, the local Korean green grocer or whatever. You know, now that all the good markets are gone, say goodbye to the last bastion in America of small, of genuine family-owned small business. By the way, to grease the skids, Walmart will donate a total of $500,000 from the Walmart Foundation to local chambers of commerce, including many minority chambers. These resources could be used in a variety of ways, including to develop websites, sponsor community events, or host business improvement sessions. And meanwhile, the Bush tax cuts are rolling along. San Francisco Chronicle reporting, David K. Johnson. Headline, Rich Gain Most from Last Tax Cut Study Says the First Data. See, this, when you get it, this what this is all about, ultimately, I mean, let's just boil this right down to the bottom line here. The bottom line is the idea that inherited wealth and corporate power are the new ideals for America. They were brought to us by Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, and of course, it wasn't a new idea then. It was brought to us by the robber barons of the 1880s, 1890s, the McKinley administration. McKinley's right-hand man, the guy that Mark Hanna, the guy that Karl Rove says he has modeled himself after. Mark Hanna, who came up with the idea of saying that the USS Maine had been blown up by the Spanish, and therefore, as I recall, it was in Havana Harbor, wasn't it? And therefore starting the Spanish-American War, in which we took Cuba and the Philippines, as a stunt to get McKinley reelected. And it worked. And McKinley did get reelected. But then he died in his second term of office. And his vice president, Teddy Roosevelt, became president. And Teddy Roosevelt became the corporate Republican's worst nightmare. But that's a whole other story. In any case, so this is all about taking us back to the age of the robber barons, back to the era of the robber barons. And the way you do that is you increase the wealth at the top, you increase the concentration, the corporate concentration of power, and you increase the ability of wealth to be maintained by families from generation to generation so that you have a new aristocracy. This is all about the death of democracy. The conservative agenda is pure and simple, nothing more, nothing less than destroying democracy and replacing it with what used to be called a plutocracy or an oligarchy. A nation ruled by plutocrats, by the wealthy few. And the idea is, and there's people of good conscience who actually believe this, this is the best thing. I mean, go back and read Russell Kirk's book, he published it in 1953, called The Conservative Mind, the book that influenced Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley. And it's a fascinating book. It's a fascinating read. And in that book, The Conservative Mind, Russell Kirk talks about how conservatives go all the way back to Sir Edmund Burke in the 1770s. Conservatives have always felt that too much democracy is dangerous. That if you allow the rabble to make the decisions, then you'll have a lack of stability. Now, history shows that the opposite is the case, unless you want to call feudalism stability. I guess you could argue that for 500 years during the Dark Ages in Europe, when you had kings and feudal lords, and only a very small percentage of the people alive had any rights whatsoever, that you had a stable society. You could argue that. I'll give you that. But life was a living hell for the vast majority of people alive. Is that the way we want to live? I don't think so. But that's the direction that the conservatives want to take us. And you see this in their tax policies. You see this in their corporate policies. You see this in Walmart saying that they're going to take the they're going to eat alive everything. You're going to end up with, and we're nearly there already, you're going to end up with, in every major sector, just a small handful of corporate plutocrats, corporate basically kings, ruling those particular realms and domains. Whether it's steel, whether it's retail trade, whether it's auto manufacturing, whether it's clothing, whether it's pick the industry and show me where in your town it's still possible to have a small mom and pop shop, to start a local business, build it up, make a decent living off it, hand it off to your children, and have it go down for a couple of generations. The American dream. Show me where that's possible in America today. It's pretty much just now in our poor neighborhoods, which Walmart today has announced they are going into. In the meantime, the first data to document this, David K. Johnson, to document the effects of President Bush's tax cuts for investment income show that they have significantly lowered the tax burden on the richest Americans, reducing taxes on incomes of more than $10 million by $500,000 on average. In other words, if you made more than $10 million a year, Bush's tax cuts gave you $500,000. Now, that means that the rest of us have to pay that $500,000. Well, actually, our children and our grandchildren are going to have to pay that $500,000. And in fact, by the time they pay it, it'll be $1 million because of interest, because, 5-7% interest over 20 years, you at least double the money. You may triple the money. But, for the millionaires, this is cool. Income's greater than $10 million, $500,000 tax savings. Tax savings, which include the two Bush cuts on compensation, nearly doubled to slightly more than $1 million after the 2003 tax cuts. If you made over $25, $26 million, you paid about the same share of income in income taxes as those making $200,000 to $500,000 because of the lowered rates on investment income. Conservatives rolling along, my friends. Time to wake up America. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
When the world has turned you down, dear, I'll be waiting. When your friends can't be found, I'll be there. When your heart is sad and weary and no longer wants to roam, when you have no place to go, please come on home.
And welcome back, my friends. Come on home to democracy in the United States. The Tom Hartman radio program, talk radio for the rest of us, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The savings from investment tax cuts are expected to be larger in subsequent years, knows David K. Johnson. Because of the tax cuts, even the merely rich, making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, are falling behind the wealthiest. Those making less than $50,000 saved an average, because of the tax cuts, of $10. $10. Aren't you happy? At the same time, David Sirota points out that the Democrats, what he refers to as the Wall Street Democrats, he calls this the Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party, has rolled out what they call the Hamilton Project. Now, this is being championed by Robert Rubin. Robert Rubin, who laid this out in a press conference at the Brookings Institution. He was the labor secretary under Clinton, as I recall, Rubin? I believe he was. He was a treasury secretary under Clinton. And Roger Altman, who worked at Treasury with him, they laid this thing out. And the Hamilton Project, after Alexander Hamilton, presumably, Alexander Hamilton, one of the early conservatives, one of the early guys who was continually having fights with Thomas Jefferson, who believed that America should become a major industrial power and an international. He was an internationalist, as it were. And most of the founders were really, rather provincial. They just thought, America for Americans. It's enough. Although, it didn't extend to Native Americans, but that's a whole other story. In any case, Roger Altman and Rob Rubin, saying that they want to blunt the political demands for protectionism. The group said it was unwilling to take on entrenched The group said it was willing to take on entrenched democratic interests such as teaching unions. So, yeah, okay, let's bust the teachers' union. You got the Democratic Party now talking about busting the teachers. I mean, this is how far it's gotten. Policy papers unveiled on Wednesday proposed vouchers for summer schools. The conservative infiltration of the Democratic Party is outrageous. We have the whole conservative agenda, the free trade, the whole so-called free trade agenda, exporting our jobs. If there's something you can manufacture in the United States, let's find a place where the labor is cheaper and manufacture it there. And if there's a job in America that can't be manufactured but has to be done somehow in some other way, you know, it requires actual labor, actual physical labor. You got to have somebody physically there doing it. Then let's bring in more workers to drive down the cost of labor. And now here, Rubin is now the head of Citigroup, by the way. He's doing very well. Thank you very much. And as David Sirota points out, he says, first, there's the dishonest name-calling aimed at those courageous Democrats who are challenging the free trade orthodoxy that is destroying the lives of millions of American and foreign workers. Then there's the promise of an ensuing attack on the labor movement, a reflexive move, of course, for a bunch of corporate executives like Rubin. And finally, the nod to efforts to defund public education through vouchers. David Sirota notes Robert Rubin, head of Citigroup, he and the folks at his press conference are the same people who ran trade deals like NAFTA, WTO, and China, PNTR, the equivalent of most favored nation status, down the throats of Americans, and then left government service for the high life of the corporate boardroom. Meanwhile, crude oil futures jumped over $67 a barrel yesterday. Gasoline prices look like they're going up. The data also showed that gasoline demand over the last 4 weeks was 1% higher than a year ago. The price of gold is going through the roof. It was over $590 the last time I looked. And what does all this mean? All this means that conservative economic policies are working. They are helping out the millionaires and billionaires, and they are screwing the middle class. The middle class, the productive class, becomes less and less wealthy. And the essentially non-productive class becomes more and more wealthy. And ironically, of course, the Wall Street Journal and other corporate apologists refer to the millionaires and billionaires among us as the productive class. And, I begged it. Speaking as an entrepreneur myself, as a person who has started 7 businesses and they have generated and not insignificant cash flow, I still disagree. I respectfully disagree. Tony in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Tony, we have 1 minute left. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, man, love listening to your show. Let me try to make this brief. I have to disagree with you on some things. Mainly that, you know, if we sell the Americans aren't going to pick lettuce, man. I'm sorry. I don't care if it's $50 an hour or whatever. And imagine what a
are you serious, Tony? You wouldn't pick lettuce for $106,000 a year?
No. Then how much is my salad going to cost me?
You know, how much is your if you're making $106,000 a year, I think you can instead of paying $4 for a salad, you can pay $4.50.
Then we're going to have to start printing more money or something. I mean, there's got to be a better.
No,
everybody should start this by reading the plaques on the Statue of Liberty. You know, that's where we should start this. I mean, this America.
That was fine, Tony, when we had unlimited land we could steal from the Native Americans.
America, well, true, but America was built.
But we don't have unlimited land that we could steal from the Native Americans anymore.
It started with the Africans being brought here. I mean.
So you're suggesting we should go back to slavery?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm African American. I don't want to see that. But I'm saying we have to recognize that, you know, this was built on the backs of foreigners.
It was built on the backs of cheap labor, and a whole lot of people got rich off it. And I think it's time that we have a middle class. And I got to say, Tony, that it's also and thank you for the call. It's also African Americans who are taking the biggest hit from illegal immigrants coming into the United States because they tend to pull down the communities that are the most oppressed in terms of wages. Say what? Bev Harris is coming up with us in the next hour. We're going to talk about what's up with those voting machines. Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America. Diebold making unannounced visits to counties, sometimes when the election supervisor is out of town, asking the assistants if they can play with the machines. This has got to be very strange. Well, we've got to go to somebody who knows something about this. Bev Harris, blackboxvoting.org. Hey, Bev.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. Great to have you back on the program, Bev. Tell me about this story. What's the deal here?
Well, actually, all three of the biggest manufacturers are in different kinds of trouble for different kinds of things. It's very surreal. Sequoia Voting Systems, of course, melted down in the recent Chicago election. Some Chicago aldermen decided to subpoena the Sequoia head honcho. And unfortunately, he can't come because he's a Venezuelan citizen who has his visa has been canceled and he's not allowed to come to the United States. That's nice. And
that's strange.
Election systems and software has just gotten in trouble for a breach of a regulation in Indiana. Diebold, of course, our favorite problem child. There was, you know, we were able to examine the TSX machines, the touch screens, the brand new ones in Emery County, Utah. And of course, Diebold is now busily trying to run the election supervisor there out of office, just as they tried to do with Florida's Ian Sancho. The reason that he wanted us to look at the machines is because he got machines with little yellow dots stuck to them. And he thought, well, that's funny. There was about a quarter of his machines. And he went to look at the machines and found out that they had less memory available, hardly any memory available, and that's strange for a brand-new machine. And
now, so by memory, do you mean like RAM working memory to run programs with, or do you mean the storage that stores the number of votes and things?
The working memory that stores the that allows the programs to run.
Okay.
And it boots up and it tells you how much there is. And these seven machines out of his 40, he's a small county, it was in the red zone, you know, and there wasn't anything left. And it was like, well, what's in there, and why are they different than the others?
Oh, you mean you're not talking about the physical memory. You're saying there were programs that were, in addition to the system program, that were sucking up all the available memory.
Right. There was something sucking it up.
Uh-huh.
And the question, the reason he brought us in is to find out what was sucking it up. And so there's this whole drama now going on in Utah where they're trying to railroad him out of office because he did this responsible thing of trying to figure out why he had, you know, one quarter of his machines had something different on them. But be that as it may.
What was on those machines?
Well, Diebold has an answer for it. They claim that the problem was they had Chinese fonts or typefaces on those machines. Well, now that's interesting, too, because why would you put a Chinese typeface on just some of the machines and send them to Utah where it's not required? Well, along in parallel with that, we know that Diebold had to, a county in California, Solano County, dumped a bunch of Diebold TSX machines, about 900 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so our theory was, well, gee, maybe they resold some of those machines as new. They had been used. So we were trying to look into that. We've just found out today from a member of the staff of the Utah Lieutenant Governor that they admit that Diebold came in and changed some serial numbers.
Is that against the law, Bev?
Well, I don't know, but it's becoming stranger and stranger because Solano County, which is the one that dumped all these machines, is saying they don't have their serial numbers anymore. They gave all their serial numbers for their multi-million dollar purchase back to Diebold.
You're kidding. And they kept no record.
Yes. And so now, that's the background for this story. What we found is we started calling election officials in different states, first to see if there's any little stick-on dots on any of their machines. Indeed, there are. We found some stick-on dots in a machine in Ohio, and we found that in Mississippi, what was happening was Diebold, when they would come in and they would test the machines, and the defective machines were being marked with stick-on dots. Okay, uh-huh. So we put all this out on the website, and lo and behold, then we start getting calls from elections officials in different states saying Diebold is showing up unannounced in at least two cases when the supervisor of elections was not even in town. They were just showing up unannounced and asking to visit the voting machines. We then found two more counties where they were replacing the motherboards in the machines, and so we publicized kind of a warning to the elections officials as far as, you know, these are the kinds of things you don't want. And when you have a manufacturer come in, they need to have a work order that needs to be authorized in advance that says what they're doing.
Right.
Now,
Bev, just a reality check here. Mm-hmm. Is this, in your opinion, or in the opinion of the election supervisors you're talking to, or both, is this a company that has sold a product that's really not ready for prime time, trying to, you know, stay ahead of the failure curve and upgrade it and fix it and perhaps even cover up the, you know, the screw-ups and just kind of keep out of trouble because they just didn't have the world's best product? Or are these, is there some concern that these machines are hackable or have been hacked or have been involved in some way in election fraud, and that somebody's trying to cover those tracks?
Well, let me put it this way. Certainly staying ahead of the defect curve, we know that the machines on acceptance testing are showing a lot of defects, but I think it's more serious than that. I think that there is a real concern that machines have been delivered as new that perhaps were not new, or that had failed testing in some other state and got, you know, shipped off to a small county, you know, figuring what'll they know, which is a different kind of fraud.
Mm-hmm.
But the other issue is when we were in Emory County, which we were called there, we brought in the Finnish security expert that did the Leon County hack, Harry Hursti, and we brought in a company called Security Innovations, very well known in the security business. And they were able to penetrate the Diebold touchscreen very quickly, and using a different technique than was used in Leon County. And it was, again, very troubling, and it was very, very serious security breach. They're working on the report right now on that. But it crosses my mind that there may be some attempts to try to obfuscate the existence of that security flaw, because
mm-hmm.
it's very serious. At any rate, you don't want them coming around visiting machines doing something that we don't know what it is.
Right, right. This is all just very weird. We have just 2 minutes or so left, Bev. Are you finding any evidence of actual election fraud as you look around here, particularly coming out of the 2004 election?
Well, the 2004 election...
Or the recent primaries.
Actually, the recent primaries, I have what everyone else has, is the tremendous and ever-growing length of anomalies. But it takes a lot of work and time to trace the anomalies back to what they are. Now, Volusia County does look like it boils down to fraud. It doesn't look, we can't really, the problem with electronic voting is you can't reconstruct the data after the data has been changed in most cases.
Right.
So you don't, you can know that someone made an illicit change and that it was done in a way that was not authorized, but you can't know what the impact of that is. It's very frustrating.
Right. This is why they want machines that don't produce a paper trail.
Well, sure. And now with the newer ones that we looked at in Emory County, the troubling thing we found about that security flaw, and I'll be very careful how I word this, but it's a very, very sophisticated and elegant backdoor that was placed in each level of the program in the architecture. By a programmer, we were able to trace it back to the programmer, by a programmer who's very experienced and considered to be a highly skilled programmer. And that is something that is probably going to take a few more months to unravel.
Right, because the question is that back door there for maintenance, or is that back door there for hacking the vote?
Well, the way it's constructed, it's not looking very good for maintenance being the answer. The way it's constructed, it looks like it was put in there for reasons that shouldn't be there, but there needs to be more replication. You know, I'm not going to run out there and accuse somebody of a criminal enterprise yet. But I will say that something really positive has happened in California, and it's the kind of thing we need to see more of because it's going to unravel this garment. The Senate Elections Committee in California, under the guidance of Deborah Bowen, who's the chair of the Elections Committee, Senator Deborah Bowen, for the first time ever got the testing labs to testify.
That's great.
She got some very troubling information out of them. I think that's going to unravel.
We had her on this program, in fact, about 3 months ago. She was talking about Bev Harris, one of the great patriots. You are just absolutely extraordinary, Bev, and I so honor you and all the years of work that you've put into this. Blackboxvoting.org, the website. Check it out. Bev, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And for the great work you're doing. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. The pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program, 21 minutes past the hour. We have, by the way, the phone number for that $106,000 a year job picking lettuce in southern Arizona. If you're interested, John McCain offering $50 an hour, $106,000 a year. Did I say $106,000 an hour? $106,000 a year, $50 an hour. And the phone number for his Phoenix office, 602-952-2410. That's area code 602-952-2410. If you'd like to apply for a job, $50 an hour picking lettuce, you got to do the whole season. But, you know. Not too shabby, 602-952-2410. Speaking of making piles of money and then having to deal with the tax consequences of it as we get closer and closer here to April 15th, Gary Smith is on the line. His website, help-with-taxes.com. His book, Help, I Owe Back Taxes. Gary K. Smith, MBA. Hey, Gary.
Good morning.
Good morning. Great to have you with us. What is the biggest mistake that people make with regard to their taxes?
I think the biggest mistake that people make with their taxes is that they don't understand the fundamentals. Most people don't understand, for example, what the itemized deductions are. That's the IRS said over 1 million people last year didn't know that they could deduct sales tax on their Schedule A. So it's some simple things, some simple fundamentals. People.
Wait a minute. At the federal level, you can deduct sales tax?
Yes, you can.
I didn't know that.
Well,
but
1 million and one.
There you go. You've got to keep your receipts, though, right?
You know, the truth is that there is a fair and reasonable clause with the IRS.
Mm-hmm.
If nothing's fair and reasonable, it almost always goes through. It's when people are not fair and not reasonable.
Now, I live in a state where there is no sales tax. I live in Oregon. So I couldn't just say, hey, you know, I mean, if I was in, I think Washington State has a 6 or 7% tax. If I lived in Washington State, or if I lived in Vermont, where I think it was, as I recall, it was around 5%, I could say, you know, this year I'm most of my income that I spent locally, I paid 5% tax. So therefore, you know, I can deduct this much.
The IRS actually has amounts listed in a regulation. They'll tell you the exact amount. But take your residents of Washington. Washington residents don't pay state income tax. But if they file a Schedule A and itemize their deduction, then they can all take sales tax.
Now, isn't there a downside to that?
Aren't
you giving up something else?
Nope, no downside.
You're not giving up a standardized deductions, for example?
Well, if your itemized deductions are higher, then you do that instead of the standard.
I see.
But over 1 million people didn't know that they could deduct sales tax.
Yeah, 1 million and 1.
A million and one. There's one other thing I wanted to let you know is all your readers should know that April 15th falls on a Saturday.
But
your listeners should. April 15th falls on a Saturday, so they have until April 17th this year.
Hmm.
So people have two more days to be anxious.
Okay. And what are the changes that – are you familiar with Ron Wyden's suggestion for a new federal tax system?
No, actually I'm not.
Okay. He's come out with a proposal that basically has three categories and is radically simplified, but it doesn't have what I perceive to be the problems with the flat tax. In what ways do you think that our tax system is broken and should be changed?
You know, this is a difficult question, and I think about it a lot because, you know, I'm a professional. My biggest problem is with tax rates. I think tax rates are too high. I think they should be less. And the other thing is I think self-employed people should get a break on Social Security tax. This is one of my biggest beefs.
Yeah, I'll agree with you on the second. On the first, though, if we're going to have a society that we're going to pay the bills on, aren't taxes the price that we pay for being a member of society? I mean, right now our children are paying for our spending. That's not fair.
Yeah, but here's an interesting statistic. The IRS figures about $350 billion is unreported in tax revenues, and they collect about $50 billion of that. So they figure close to $300 billion a year is not being collected.
You mean because of tax fraud?
Underground economy, that
sure.
kind of thing.
Yeah,
and I think
now an awful lot of that is actually illegal underground economy, if I recall correctly. Things like, you know, people dealing drugs and whatnot.
I think it's a lot more just basic self-employed people, contractors, and cash business.
Illegal immigrants.
Yeah, and I think the way the tax system's created, it kind of makes citizens criminals because it's difficult. It's very difficult to be a contractor, for example. And make a living between workman's comp and all the taxes. It's so hard.
Yeah,
and then with the illegal immigrants, then how do you compete?
Yeah, but I agree. But you're saying that the tax rates are too high, and yet they're not paying the cost of government. And we have a government that apparently we the people want, or we would vote the bums out of office. And don't we have an obligation to pay the cost of government?
Oh, I agree. But I think if we paid less, more people would pay.
Well, it's a nice theory. I mean, that was Ronald Reagan's theory. It didn't seem to work, but interesting.
I tell you, if the first $10,000 of income for self-employed people was not subject to Social Security tax, you'd collect a lot more money.
I'm all in favor of that. Gary, we got to wrap it up. Gary Smith, the book Help, I Owe Back Taxes, helpwithtaxes.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back with friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics. 1-800-511-MAX for Macintosh products all across the United States. 1-800-511-MACS. Give them a call. Tell them Tom Hartman said hi. And also Eco Wine, the organic wine company, 1-888-ECO-WINE for mind-bogglingly good-tasting and reasonably priced imported organic French wines, 1-888-ECO-WINE.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The liberal shadow knows.
Yes, the liberal shadow has found another one for you here. That's me, by the way. A mobile phone salesman was hauled off a plane and questioned for 3 hours as a terror suspect. This is from the London Daily Mail. Why? Haraj Mann, 24, played the punk anthem London Calling in the classic rock track Immigrant Song in a taxi before a flight to London. He lives in Hartlepool, Tidesea, he'd boarded the plane at Durham Tees Valley Airport when the flight to Heathrow was stopped and he was arrested by police. He was told he was being questioned under the Terrorism Act, because his choice of music in the taxi had aroused suspicions. If you haven't seen the movie V for Vendetta, you know, you gotta go see this thing. Anyhow, Mr. Mann said yesterday the taxi had one of those tape deck things that plugs into your digital music player. He says, I played Procol Harum's Whiter Shade of Pale first, which the taxi man liked. I figured he liked the classics, so I put on a bit of Led Zeppelin, the Immigrant Song, which he didn't like. Then, since I was going to London, I played the song by The Clash and finished up with Nowhere Man by The Beatles. Well, apparently the taxi driver thought this was suspicious, and so he called the British equivalent of Homeland Security and said, I just took this guy to the airport, and he's playing subversive music. Mr. Mann said he was frog marched off the plane in front of everyone, had my bag searched, and was asked every question you could think of. He added, it turned out the taxi driver alerted someone when I arrived at the airport and had spoken about my music. He didn't like Led Zeppelin or The Clash, but there's no need to tell the police. Durham police said the action was taken as a result of information received, and the flight was stopped before takeoff. Be afraid. Be very afraid. By the way, in honor of the 43rd president, Campbell's Soup, or so the story goes, has introduced a new flavor, Campbell's Condensed Soup. Just has a W on the can. It's, you know, W Soup. Consists of a weenie and hot water. Go figure. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind?
Before I go on to the main topic, I'll alert people to the most important movie of the year, I think, America from Freedom to Fascism, done by Aaron Russo, Bette Midler's ex-manager. And, that movie is going to have free screenings in San Francisco and Las Vegas this weekend. People should
Great.
Look out for it. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. You remember, I told you, Peter DeFlazio was in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
So that's
America from Freedom. From Freedom to America, From Freedom to Fascism.
Oh, yes. It's a great movie, and it's funny, too. The thing is, people bitching and kvetching about Katie Couric. There's the stupid, editorial cartoonist for the Oregonian. You had a thing about Walter Cronkite reading the news that Katie Couric is going to be the new news anchor at CBS, tear coming from Walter Cronkite's eye, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this is so stupid. I mean, you know, number one, I believe CBS's standards for the anchor chair haven't always been so high. I seem to remember Connie Chung was in that anchor chair for a few years.
Well, Connie Chung was a pretty serious news person.
Well,
you know, but
I didn't think so. She's married to Maury Povich, for God's sakes.
Yeah, but just because she's married to somebody, I mean, you know, Andrea Mitchell's married to Alan Greenspan. That you know, you want something to give you the creeps. What I find really interesting about this, Joe, is if you look at Think Progress, the liberal website, they have audio clips. They point to MediaMatters.org, which has clips, audio clips on there, where Katie Couric is saying things like,
"It's a company that is as American as mom and apple pie, Walmart."
American.
The chamber erupted in applause 60 times, but during most of those times, Democrats sat on their hands. The only moment the Democrats really applauded was when the president talked about his failed plan to reform Social Security.
And see, that actually wasn't true. And saying that Walmart is as American as mom and apple pie. And then she tried, you know, a Republican talking point on Howard Dean, and he wouldn't let her get away with it.
Corruption scandals in Congress. Tom DeLay, all these folks involved in getting money, all of whom are Republicans, from Jack Abramoff. We need a real
overhaul.
Hey,
wait a second.
Democrats
took money from Jack Abramoff, too, Mr. Dean.
That is absolutely false. That did not happen.
Now, maybe she got corrected. Now, here's the flip side of it, Joe, and this is what I find so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You go over to Accuracy in Media, the right-wing site, and he's got a news release on Katie Couric, and he basically says, let's see here. It's on the Today Show, Kirk had it, but a lot of she has been hired by CBS apparently because she is a liberal who projects a pleasant, warm, and friendly appearance. Putting a pretty face and a sweet voice on liberal bias won't fool viewers for long. So she's being criticized by the conservatives for being too liberal. She's being criticized by the liberals for being too conservative. So my guess is she's probably a reasonable person.
Well, let me put something out there people might not know about her. There was a series done on PBS all about labor history in the long ago past, and she narrated it.
Mm-hmm.
She did the narration for this this series about labor on PBS. So this thing about, she's right wing and this sort of total nonsense.
Yeah.
Total nonsense.
Yeah. I have a feeling that she's probably more of just an old line journalist, or at least an old line TV performer.
Well, I think she can be serious when she wants to be.
Yeah. Well, we will see. And I suspect that you're probably right, Joe, and that CBS wouldn't have put her on if that wasn't the case. And it's going to be interesting to watch. It's going to be interesting to see how this thing plays out. But, it's not, Katie Couric is not, maybe, I don't know. Excuse me, I was going to say she's not necessarily going to be the salvation of CBS News. CBS News is always going to be the whipping boy of the right wing. I mean, they have been ever since Ed Murrow took on Joe McCarthy. I mean, it's just, they've been going after CBS News. So whether that's the case or not, I don't know. We'll see. So the Berlusconi thing, the elections are ongoing. We'll keep you up to date on that as time goes on. This is something that concerns me a lot. And Joe, thanks for bringing up the Katie Couric thing. I've been meaning to do that all day here. The conservatives, this from the hotline, the National Journal's daily briefing on politics. So from nationaljournal.com. And the headline, conservatives want caucuses, not primaries. You'll recall in the last hour, I was talking about the conservative agenda not just being about cheap labor, but also being about the end of democracy. What conservatives ultimately want is an anti-democratic outcome. That is, they want a rule by an elite few. That's why they are continuously using the word elite and trying to attach it to liberals, so that it will lose its impact and it will be difficult to attach it to them. This is a classic strategy. You accuse the other people of what you are doing, and then when they say, "Oh no, you're doing it," they look silly, right? Or they have their claim has less potency. And so for 15 years, you've had Limbaugh talking about the liberal elite, but the reality is that the hard conservatives, the hard right conservatives in the United States, represent a very tiny minority. The people who really and truly understand what it means to be a hard-right conservative. I'm not talking about the person who's just voting Republican because they think abortion should be illegal or because they think they pay too much taxes. I'm talking about the people who really understand the conservative agenda. We're probably talking about something on the order of a tenth to a hundredth of 1% of the population of this country. It is a very small number of people. And the number of people who, by and large, agree with them or are willing to go along with them, who identify themselves as extremely conservative, a larger percentage, but it's still probably 15%, 20% of Americans, maybe not even that. So the conservatives, in order to try to retain power, keeping in mind that the entire conservative agenda is about maintaining power, maintaining corporate power, maintaining the power of wealth, maintaining inherited wealth. And let me just, be on the record. I'm not opposed to people leaving money to their children and their grandchildren so that they never have to work again five generations down the road. And there's a limit. We don't want to have a landed gentry in the United States. So the founders were very clear about that. But that gets us into the whole thing about the estate tax, so we need not go there. But in any case, the headline in the hotline, the conservatives want caucuses, not primary. Under nearly everyone's radar, conservative activists in a handful of mostly Western and Midwestern states are edging closer to providing their base voters with a much greater say in choosing presidential candidates. They're doing this in Washington, California, Oregon, and elsewhere. Activists affiliated with the National Federation of Republican Assemblies are trying to get caucuses in their state laws instead of primaries. Why? Because caucuses is where a small number of people in a room decide who the candidate's going to be, and a primary is where a large number of voters decide who the candidate's going to be. In primaries, you tend to get more moderate people being elected. In caucuses, you tend to get the more extreme people elected. Because, only the hardcore base shows up for the caucuses, whereas, larger percentage of the people will show up for the primaries. And so this is really, really interesting. And the supporters of Mitt Romney and Sam Brownback, in particular, Sam Brownback, the guy who wants to replace the Constitution with the Bible, and Mitt Romney, the Mormon Republican from Massachusetts, are behind this thing, this push for caucuses, this conservative strategy. 45 minutes past the hour.
the Tom Hartman Program.
You're beautiful. You're beautiful. You're beautiful. It's true.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Amazing. The press corps today, knowing that Scooter Libby had said that Bush authorized the leak of classified information that apparently included Valerie Plame's name, the senior administration official who authorized this, the traitor, to quote George Herbert Walker Bush, who authorized this, was nonetheless, was none other than George W. Bush himself, the leaker. The senior administration official who was the leaker was George W. Bush himself.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
And the White House press corps knew that Bush was the leaker, or at least that Scooter Libby had identified Bush as the leaker to Patrick Fitzgerald, and Patrick Fitzgerald had published that this morning, and yet not one single member of the press corps asked Scotty McClellan about it. Not one. And interestingly, this just in, a Bush event just went off script. George W. Bush giving a talk someplace to a hand-picked audience, only Republicans allowed, tickets, the whole bit. And a guy stands up, a guy by the name of Harry Taylor, in a balcony seat, looking down at Bush on the stage. He stands up and says, "I feel like despite your rhetoric, that compassion and common sense have been left far behind during your administration, and I would hope from time to time that you have the humility and grace to be ashamed of yourself." Just moments ago, this was said to George W. Bush. Meanwhile, Andrew Selsky in the Associated Press reports about the Guantanamo detainees. He says they wait in cells as small as 8 feet long and 6 feet 8 inches wide, and say they dream of farming in the wide open spaces of Afghanistan, working on a ship on the high seas, or caring for elderly parents in Tajikistan. The yearnings of some of the hundreds of detainees captured in the war on terror are unveiled in transcripts of administration review boards. This is the result of a Freedom of Information Act filings. A few of the 715 men in Guantanamo Bay, more than 4 years, just under half the detainees live in small cells, the bunk affixed to a green steel mesh wall. They have a metal sink to wash in and a hole in the ground for a toilet. Said Mohammed Al-Sah, an Afghan accused of having links to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. He said he was a doctor with rebel forces fighting Soviet troops during the 1979 occupation of Afghanistan. However, he denied being involved with anti-U.S. forces. If freed, he said he wants to return to his hometown of Gardez to work as a doctor. Another Afghan detainee, a tribal leader accused of fighting for the Taliban, said he only wants to go home, work his land, and open a gas station. "All my life," he said, "my desire was to have a quiet life and to do good things," he told a U.S. military tribunal deciding whether he was a threat to the United States. "That was my dream," he said. The AP got these under a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit. Human rights organizations say innocent people are among those who have been swept up by the U.S. forces and their allies. A Yemeni, classified as an enemy combatant, insists that he'd gone to Afghanistan to teach children Arabic and the Quran, the Muslim holy book. He urged the Administrative Review Board to release him. "What do you think you'll do when you return back to Yemen?" one of the panelists asked. "The only thing I will do is take care of agriculture. That's all I know. That's my job. Cultivate the earth and plant seeds and fruits," he said. "My parents are in Tajikistan. I'm an only child," said another detainee. "I would take care of my parents and I will continue my life over there." Meanwhile, Amnesty International says interviews with former detainees have lent support to the idea that Eastern European countries may be involved in CIA flights to black site prisons. For Afghanistan, three men now describe travel times, climate, temperature, sunrises, and prayer times that changed according to daylight savings time. Amnesty says the detailed descriptions indicate that they could have been held in Eastern Europe. Men were held for 13 months at a secret prison and returned to Yemen. This is the process of rendition. Amazing what's going on. And meanwhile, Daniel Pipes, one of the most fervent cheerleaders for the Iraq War, one of the guys who was rewarded for coming up with the idea of the Iraq War with a recess appointment to the U.S. Institute for Peace because he couldn't get through the Senate, he now says the problem with the Iraq War, the ingratitude of the Iraqis for the favor we gave them. Amazing. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's on your mind today? Armin?
Hello.
No Armin. Okay.
Hello?
Yeah, Armin.
You got me. All right.
I'm not hearing him. Buckley, William F. Buckley, the conservative, the right-wing conservative, well, you know, I would say one of the founders of the modern conservative movement, blogging, as it were. This Judy Woodruff writes in Bloomberg News. William F. Buckley, the longtime conservative writer and leader, said George W. Bush's presidency will be judged entirely by the outcome of the war in Iraq, and it's now a failure. Buckley said, Mr. Bush is in the hands of a fortune that will be unremitting on the point of Iraq. If he'd invented the Bill of Rights, it wouldn't get him out of this jam. He goes, now, keep in mind, this is probably the most highly respected voice in the entire conservative world. He says, it's important that we acknowledge in the Inner Council of States that the war has failed, so that we should look for opportunities to cope with that failure. He's 80 years old now, the grand old man of the conservative movement. Asked who is to blame for what he deems a failure, Buckley said, the president. He called Don Rumsfeld a failed executor of the war. Said Vice President Dick Cheney, quote, was flatly misled. He believed the business about the weapons of mass destruction. See, Buckley's still cutting Cheney some slack here. Yeah. He criticized the so-called neocons who enthusiastically embraced the Iraq invasion and the spreading of American values around the world. He said the neoconservative hubris, which sort of assigns to America some kind of geostrategic responsibility for maximizing democracy, overreaches the resources of a free country.
You've been listening to the
well
Tom
said.
Hartman program.
Check and yet Dan Pipes, the neocon, who one of the founders of this thing,
of this program,
the ingratitude of the Iraqis is the problem. The extraordinary favor we gave them to release them from the bondage